Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
This is Rich Little as Johnny Carson, and you're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk, and she's got a big audience. All my wives listen.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo and you're listening to Real Talk. Believe it or not, the phrase America First is offensive to some, but does it actually express the heart of the movement, Make America Great Again? And ever wonder why the UN is so anti-Israel and anti-American? Well, its Soviet founders might have something to do with that. Well, we're going to discuss this and more with my next guest. For my new listeners, Diana West is a nationally syndicated conservative American columnist and author. Her columns and blogs tackle controversial subjects such as the impact of Islam and the failures of counterinsurgency. She is the author of several best-selling books, including The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana has contributed essays and features to numerous periodicals, including The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, and The Washington Post. She has also been a columnist for The Washington Times, Scripps Howard News Service, and United Media. Diana is a popular analyst and contributor on both radio and TV. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Diana West.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I always love coming on the show, Audrey, and getting that Real Talk welcome.
Oh, well, it's so great to have you back with us. It's really a lot has happened since the last time you were on the show, and I think we both have big smiles on our faces right now.
Well, it's I'm still rubbing my eyes, but I am starting to get used to it. I spent most of the weekend rubbing my eyes over and kind of checking my ears on President Trump, but that's where we are. And they have hit the ground running, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in a recent piece, you wrote that America First, that this is a revolutionary underpinning of the Trump movement. Can you expound on that for us?
Yes, and I would say that in the weeks leading up to the inauguration, I was feeling a little uneasy. I'm not hot on some of the picks in the cabinet, or I was getting some funny messaging and watching certain things that seemed to be developing. And then I heard his inauguration address. It was absolutely superb in the sense that he reconnected with the 63 million voters who put him in Washington in a way that was bold and so unusual. And when I thought about it later, it was really the best thing he could have done. And this speech, which raised all kinds of hackles around the establishment right and left that we've talked about, for this very concept of America First, which is simply fascinating to me, because once upon a time, such an expression of simple patriotism, simple concern that your country, or simple feeling that your country, you love it better than any other country in the world, would have actually not been necessary, would have been something that everybody in the society naturally understood as the underpinning of any kind of presidency. But over the past 100 years, we have seen that sense of nationhood and of patriotism, I will say, that kind of patriotism, to become practically a dirty word, practically a concept that is to be shunned. And you see this in the reaction by the pundits to this speech. But what I've heard from it was this notion that, yes, he was going to be doing counter-revolutionary things that his candidacy represented, which is simply America first in the very realms of immigration, in the realm of manufacturing and trade, in the realm of wars when they help America primarily, when they defend our borders, our interests, not those of the rest of the world. And this is, some would say revolutionary, I would say counter-revolutionary, because I think it does go back to a touchstone of the very development of the nation itself. And this is kind of the way I would frame the speech.
Yeah, you had actually a blog, a tweet from Bill Kristol. I could not believe what I was reading.
Yeah.
He said he found it profoundly depressing and vulgar to hear an American president proclaim America first. I'm scratching my head on that one.
Well, it's something that has been really eradicated from our conception of being a good citizen. I mean, this is kind of when you go back to American Betrayal, and which is really the prequel to my other book, my first book, The Death of the Grown-Up, I find. You do see this whole movement that really does come out of the normalization of all kinds of ideas of globalism coming from socialist ideas, communist ideas, Marxist ideas that we have gradually incorporated in not just on the left in this country, but on the right, which is this way of thinking of the world not as a world of nations, but a world whereby certain nations take the lead, which would be the right-wing way of looking at it, or on the left, seeing us as a global kind of organized societies in which barriers in trade, barriers in nation disappear. And one of the things that I was tracking during this election period, this campaign period, was how far these same ideas, once associated with the left, had penetrated establishment Republican circles. And what really fascinated me was to go back and actually look at some of the communist dogma as set forth by communist functionaries in the United States. I'm thinking of William Foster, wrote a book in the 1930s called Toward a Soviet America. And he actually described many of the precepts which I would say define modern-day Republican politics as much as they do Democratic. And that would be this idea borders, there are no trade barriers. This concept of I guess in on the right it would be seen a multilateral kind of way of looking at the world. And again on the left, this global idea. But they are very, very similar. And at the top of these organizations are always elites who have more in common with each other, regardless of their origin or even political orientation on the spectrum, than they do with the people. And this is where you come back to this incredible notion that we have seen a populist kind of movement take shape, whereby people connecting with Donald Trump's message have joined the political system, at least for this past election, in huge numbers, and have made a tremendous shift in what had been the status quo. And this is where you see really the bitter enders today are not so much the Democrats, but these establishment Republicans like Bill Kristol and many, many others who are right now trying to reckon with the Trump administration taking shape. And I would bring up something that just really astonished me. I will be having a piece about it soon in the Daily Caller, which was an article in the Washington Post about a special assistant hire, a special assistant to the president hire. She's a marvelous reporter for Breitbart News. She's 25 years old. Her name is Julia Hahn. She's one of my favorite reporters. She was hired to join the Trump White House and the by Steve Bannon, and she was profiled, you might say, or at least noted in a front section story as having broken every single possible Washington rule there exists in terms of somebody being hired who might actually believe in the Trump agenda and want to go work for it in the White House. And it's an extraordinary attack on her that just goes to show how wounded this beast really is, that you go after such a person who, frankly, I am thrilled for her, and this is a good thing for America, in my view, but she is a special assistant to the president. I looked it up and could figure out that there are about 70 of these people. Is the Washington Post going to profile each and every one? Of course not. This is something that they are doing. They're looking at a third-level kind of staff assistant, a mid-level person, and singling them out because she crosses a red line. Trump is not allowed to have people in this White House who actually believe as he does. And that kind of goes to show that they think the election is over. Now Trump has to play by Washington rules. Yeah. Well, this is a big moment for Trump. He cannot play by Washington rules or he will lose his power. He has to remain in touch and in good standing with the people who sent him to Washington, because that is the source of his power.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the fact you brought up the fact that many people that were not engaged prior in the process now suddenly were involved. And I think that if he does, and I think he will, accomplish the things that he said he would do, that these people will again be involved in the process.
I think that's very true. I think what's the fascinating thing about Trump, and this is something I'm working on, I'm working on a larger project about, has to do with this idea that, you know, people are very aware that he brought issues into this election that were essentially over. They were settled. We were never supposed to have any kind of public debate on our borders, on immigration policy, on trade policy. These things would never have come into the debate. We don't even have debates previously about our foreign policy. It was done. It was settled. And this is where you start seeing the power of what some people call the uniparty, this idea that whether it's a Clinton or a Bush or another Clinton or another Bush or an Obama, you're essentially going to have certain givens as to how very big pieces of our policies are conducted, and that would be in foreign affairs or these other kinds of immigration and trade affairs, which have such importance, but we're not supposed to talk about. These were the policies that energized what became a Trump base, and this is what the Washington establishment is so frightened of. And it fascinates me because in this same piece I'm talking about in the Washington Post, there's actually this section where the reporter is discussing this terrible idea that this young woman, Julia Hahn, being hired by this White House, reveals that Trump will go forward with his legislative priorities, and if he gets pushback from legislative Republicans in Congress, he may agitate the party's base if necessary. That's a quote from the story. And you think, wait a minute, democracy, you know, people who voted for the president, they may actually get involved. No, this is not supposed to happen. It's hilarious on one side, but on the other, it's pretty damning. And I think that Trump and some of his very good advisors, his better advisors, understand this and will keep him true. But the pitfall for him, I think the biggest one, is that he actually tries to get along with Republicans in Washington in a very meaningful sense, in terms of compromise, in terms of being liked by them and being accepted by them. I mean, that is a big no-no. It's like, if he starts getting along, if people start saying nice things about him on the Hill, something's wrong. And this is something that really needs to be kind of made clear, I think, to this staff, because he will do well so long as he continues to be counter-revolutionary and completely destabilizing the establishment. That's the only way to drain the swamp.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we have to worry about that with him. just don't.
Right. I think it's a personality trait. But,
yes.
You know, there's certain things. For example, we watched, I think that when he came out after San Bernardino in December of 2015 and called for a ban on Islamic immigration until we figure it out, if you remember that famous moment, that, for example, has been worked on by official Washington, by frightened Washington, by fearful people over so much time that we're now down to kind of a vague thing about countries where there's terrorism and extreme vetting, and we haven't really sorted through all that. I think that was an instance where you see his instinct, which was excellent and fact-based. He was going to what was a Kellyanne Conway poll, actually, that Frank Gaffney's shop had commissioned on the popularity of Sharia and so on among Muslims, which bodes ill for our own liberties, as we've discussed. That was a very good, very Trumpian kind of reaction to take, but I believe it's been kind of, oh, well, you know, molded and sort of softened over the campaign period with certain kinds of eruptions of his instinct coming back. He gave a very good speech, for example, toward the end of, I think it was the end of the summer, discussing the very importance of keeping Sharia out of our system. But that's an area where I think you do see attrition, and I don't think it's common, but it's a very important piece of it, and I'm that would be my one criticism so far of the administration, which is exactly, 24 hours old? But is basically, I'm not seeing Islam-savvy people entering into the highest echelon, and that would be something to watch for. We really need some sharp, frank, and educated people around him advising on matters of Islamic law and Islamization and so on. So that's one place to watch. But on the whole, basically, you know, his instincts, his idiosyncratic way is exactly what it is that created his movement, and, you know, long may it wave.
Yes, exactly. You know, I wanted to just touch on your article about Senator Joseph McCarthy. I mean, he's become, to the left, the media and Hollywood, a demonic figure. But the facts, the facts reveal the opposite to be true concerning Senator McCarthy. Isn't that correct?
Well, it is correct. And the great scholar, whom unfortunately, tragically, we lost, Stanton Evans, wrote a fantastic, really game-changing, world-shifting book called Blacklisted by History that was a tremendous feat of detective work, frankly, to put together the McCarthy story using original sources, not the narrative as it had been set in all kinds of secondary and tertiary sources over the years. It's a long book. I think it's 700-plus pages, but one of the things that Stan Evans, who I'm proud to claim was my friend and supporter even of my book, American Betrayal, one of the things he did shortly before his death was he wrote a piece that essentially quantified Senator McCarthy's findings in the early 1950s when his committee, among many others in the House and the Senate, were doing these kinds of investigations, trying to figure out how it was that so many communists and Soviet agents also had entered the federal government and other institutions. He was concentrating on the government only. People often confuse him with Hollywood and nothing to do with the House hearings. He was Senator McCarthy, House hearings into Hollywood, which was a separate matter. But in his examination of communists in the federal government, secret communists, these are not open people, these are covert people under party discipline or actually working for Stalin. I mean, this is what we're looking at here, trying to see. Stan put together a table, which I link to in the piece, that identified 50 ideological communists, Soviet agents, and what he called Fifth Amendment pleaders, who were people who did not answer the questions and the questioning for fear of incriminating themselves when they came before committees, people who were essentially supporting and loyal to or sympathetic to Stalin, Mao, and a whole wave of genocidal dictators. So when you look at this table of 50 and you think, my goodness, that's quite a record and quite a fantastic accomplishment that was very helpful for our national security in terms of revealing the extent to which we had been infiltrated, not for our good. So yes, this is something that really confounds people. People continue to smear him. I mean, he would be 119 years old today, Senator McCarthy, a very, very old man who's taken so much abuse. Given what he was up against. He was up against a machine very much like what we see President Trump dealing with in terms of a united front against everything he does. And I'm sure, very difficult to get up every day and go and face the lions and do what it was that he was able to accomplish before he died at an extremely shockingly young age of 48. Mm-hmm. He was gone. So that's sort of the short story in McCarthy. What I was writing about had to do with how many conservatives have fallen prey to this same calumny and use it as a way of explaining anything bad. They use McCarthy as the example. This to me shows again this idea of how it is that the right has been similarly subverted, influenced, whatever word, co-opted, whatever you want to say, by this same really Marxist vector. I mean, this is where we get all these words come out of the Daily Worker when you go right back to it. And so you have conservatives today, including people who know better. The person I highlight in the piece is David Horowitz, and his own record going back many decades as to what he knows is the truth, because he actually lived through it. This is something that really, I think, in order to understand for our own good today, we have to get a handle that, yes, there are enemies, foreign and domestic, and they do get into our government, whether they are leftists, you know, working for China, or Soviet agents working for the old USSR, or the new Russia. I mean, we still have FSB to worry about. There's a wonderful book that came out by Pete Early, the former Washington Post reporter, called Comrade J, which was telling us about a very important spymaster in the United States, Comrade J, under the post-Soviet regime in Russia, in working in the United States to subvert us and influence and all those things. And I mean, these things still happen. And of course, we also have the gigantic other side of this coming out of the Islamic world, looking at Muslim Brotherhood, Iranian lobby, Saudi influence, all these things coming into our very open and free society, trying to take us down. And so the whole concept of an enemy really is something that we have to come to grips with, that it still exists, it always did exist. It was not just a red scare, it was real, it was a red reality, and we still have problems, and we still have a lot to be on guard for and be responsible in order to preserve and protect our Constitution. And I think we actually have a chance in these Trump years to do all of those things, and that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that that phrase, red reality. Well, Diana, why was the press back in the 1950s so diametrically opposed to what McCarthy was doing?
Well, it's kind of the same old, same old. I mean, we have the media very often is very liberal. Now, there were exceptions back in the day. You had the Chicago Tribune, for example, which was a very had been a very anti-FDR paper, would you know, write in a more acceptant or better way about the McCarthy investigations, other investigations as well, going back into the 1930s. Actually, going right back to the 1920s, we started having congressional investigations into Soviet interference in our country. But you also had a lot of media who were also working for the Soviets, or fellow travelers, or dupes. I mean, it's a true thing when you go back to the Office of War Information, which was created during World War II. It was essentially our censorship organization in terms of war news. You had it absolutely chock-a-block with Soviet agents, straight up Soviet agents. And these were people working in media. These were people who went on to work in media. You have Joseph Barnes, for example, was a Soviet agent. He was in Office of War Information, I forget his position, very high up. And he was a very important journalist. He was also a book editor, I believe, at Simon & Schuster. I mean, these were the kinds of people who were operating in our society. Wilfred Burchett is another name that comes to mind. Many, many others. Later we found out that I.F. Stone was also in the employ of the KGB. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was not a joke. This really happened. So the media was essentially as infiltrated as was the Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower and on White Houses in terms of Soviet agents, ideological communists, and the rest. So this was a serious problem. And of course, if you have someone trying to expose, bring to light, throw the sunshine in on this kind of secret, dark activity, they are going to be a lightning rod of disinformation and smears and all the rest of it. So this is the same problem. And, you know, to me, when I started looking at history when I was doing American Betrayal, I found myself increasingly on the side of the people, regardless of party, who wanted to open up the secrets, especially when they're on the taxpayer dime. I mean, you know, this isn't even a matter of privacy. Public officials holding secrets and being infiltrated and so on, the most important secrets that should not exist, that should be open to the people. These were the kinds of the way it became for me to judge the era, who was for opening it up and who was trying to shut it down. And that became a whole new way of looking at the history of the time and its players.
Right. You know, it might be a foolish question, but with this kind of infiltration, was there no vetting then?
No, there really wasn't. I mean, I think that particularly in the Depression years, which was considered, you know, a tremendous crisis that the government was leading on the solution, so-called, there was really no vetting. It was just a creation, a massive mushrooming of government agencies. And this is where you see your Alger Hisses and your Whitaker Chambers and the scads of organized Soviet-directed cells coming up into the federal government with virtually no vetting. It was famously known, the Agriculture Department, for example, was a trap door, they called it, into the government. And one of Whitaker Chambers' first missions when he came to Washington was to help move agents into the bigger departments, such as the State Department, such as Alger Hiss. I mean, this is what was going on. And certainly during the war, you had the same kind of sense of chaotic urgency that permitted this kind of influx, especially once they had established beachheads and simply referred each other. And this was something that was a very important role of certain Soviet agents, for example, those serving in the White House itself, like a Lachlan Curry, who was one of President Roosevelt's top aides. One of his roles was actually to help promote people, to help deflect attention if people were raising their eyebrows over certain things, that thinking they might be spies. You know, they became protectors as well, not just simply spies or influence agents themselves. So there was a whole network and series of roles that would be defined for all these various people. But I mean, the place was riddled with them. And we've already, as scholars and looking at these archival releases, which are limited, we don't have everything. This is something else I think should be opened up. But what we do have show us that we've got over 500 identified agents. Just
wow.
Here,
oh my
which
goodness.
Is a lot. I mean, it's huge. And some of them were, as you and I have talked about, vis-a-vis yeah. American Betrayal, yeah. which goes into all of this, some of them were sitting right at the president's elbow. So, I mean, this was very serious and had a very huge impact on our own policymaking and war fighting. And this is, you know, really the essence of what that book does is examine this and wonder about it, wonder how the world was changed by this secret intelligence war exactly. that was waged. So, you know, all of this continues kind of to linger over us and because the sort of liberal world order that FDR inaugurated is really intact, and it's really what it is that Donald Trump, whether he understands it that way or not, threatens and actually has promised to essentially break up.
Yeah. Oh, Yeah, I can feel the shudders here right now. I would love to continue this, continue it further. We'll have you back soon again, I hope, to continue this. But I have to ask you one quick question here. Where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work?
Oh, well, thank you for that question. The best place is my website, which is dianawest.net. And I'm also on Twitter. You can find all that good stuff there. It's Diana_West_ is my Twitter handle, but I'm pretty easy to locate. Absolutely. With a quick Google search. But that's where you can find my books and my latest articles and such.
We'll make it even easier than that, because I will have all that information that Diana just shared with us in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the on-air button, and right under the show description, you'll find all that information, including the links to take you right there that Diana shared. Thanks so much, Diana, for sharing your brilliant assessments with us.
Oh, thank you.
Will you come back?
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you. Oh. Yes, I look forward to coming back.
Excellent. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you.